This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. Okay, so here's a quick question about why there are no videos online of my speeches in Germany. Is this some kind of conspiracy to where the Germans don't want my videos online? I don't think so. There actually is a video of me speaking in Germany, in Berlin. So if you search my name on YouTube and you put in Yaron Brook Berlin, I think you'll find one of my talks. It's not very well taped. It's like on an iPhone. So it's not a great recording, but it's there. The other two places, Halle, I think recorded it. And I wouldn't be surprised if it appeared on YouTube one of these days, maybe before even this podcast goes up. And the one in Cologne, I don't know if it was videotaped, but there's certainly no reason why it wouldn't go up if it was videotaped. And there's certainly nothing unique about Germany in terms of not videotaping. Some of my talks are videotaped, and this is completely dependent on the host that invites me to give the talk, and some of them are not. I try to encourage videotaping, and once it's videotaped, I encourage it to go up online, and I hope the talk in Halle and maybe the talk in Cologne go up soon. You always give Hong Kong as your favorite example of how capitalism works to the extent that it is practiced. Why do you never use Dubai, which appears to be at least equally impressive in terms of its incredible development over the last decades? If Hong Kong was a fishing village on a rock, wasn't Dubai the equivalent in the desert? Yes and no, but no important ways. One, Dubai is what it is because of oil, and only because of oil. Oil that was developed, was in a sense created as a resource by Western companies and was stolen by Saudi Arabia, by the Emirates, and exploited as a consequence. Dubai's wealth is almost exclusively the consequence of this oil. And its success is almost exclusively the consequence of oil. It's not a consequence of real entrepreneurship on the part of the people in Dubai. It's not a consequence of economic freedom. The skyscrapers are all a consequence of oil wealth that is being generated primarily by princes, by tribal leaders, not by entrepreneurs. Now, has Dubai used some of that wealth to create a relatively economic free area within Dubai? Again, yes and no. Yes, there are very few regulations. You can start a business. They're trying to attract hedge funds. They're trying to attract. But is there really a rule of law in Dubai? I don't believe so. If the rulers of Dubai decide to change the laws, to take away your property rights, that they're going under Sharia tomorrow, they will do so. There's no constitution. There's no tradition of rule of law. There is the will of the ruler, and the will of the ruler in this case provides for it. Now, Hong Kong is in a precarious position today as well because China's come in, and China is chipping away at the rule of law. But China developed from a fishing village into what it is today with no natural resources, no oil, no natural gas, no pipelines, no refining capacities developed by foreigners. It's all self-produced. It's all a consequence of entrepreneurship that is a consequence of the rule of law, the protection of property rights. So Hong Kong as a fishing village starts with property rights. The British come and they establish property rights, and they establish the rule of law. And it's really the rule of law if you look at the way the legal system set up and the way it was exercised. And then people come, and then wealth is created. So the wealth is a creature of the rule of law, of entrepreneurship, of capitalism. And the success of Hong Kong is all due to the fact that it was rule of law and capitalism. The fact that today that rule of law is being chipped away, Hong Kong will suffer the consequences, unfortunately. Dubai is the opposite. The wealth was all created because of the absence of the rule of law, because princes and tribal leaders owned, and I put owned in quotes, the natural resources. Ultimately, they stole the natural resources. They imported the refining capacity. They imported the technology. It was all, you know, foreign capital, foreign know-how, and fun. And they came in there, and there were no property rights, and there was no protection of the rule of law. then maybe you could argue that today they're trying to establish property rights and to establish the rule of law. If that's true, that's a good thing. But it's not the case that Dubai is a manifestation of capitalism. It's not at all. You know, capitalism would have resulted in a very different way in which wealth would have been allocated in that part of the world. I mean, there are lots of other problems with Dubai. The fact that the way rights, there are no real individual rights in Dubai. You know, if you're a guest worker in Dubai, you have no rights at all. That is not the case in Hong Kong. Immigrants there were given the full protection of the law. So it's a very, very, very different at a deep level situation between the two countries. I'm going to take one question about Ebola, even though I've addressed some of this in a previous podcast. This is about why everybody supports sending military troops to Africa to fight the disease, to fight Ebola. Even Ben Carson, who the questioner obviously views with some respect, is calling for our forces to go overseas to do this. Why is this the case? I mean, it's simple. This is pure altruism. This is placing the well-being, the lives of young American soldiers in harm's way for no American interest, purely for altruistic reasons. It's a sacrifice of our young people for the sake of Africa, for the sake of Africa that cannot cope by itself with the spread of the disease. And this is pure sacrifice, and it's wrong. The American military should only be used in the self-defense of American lives and property. It should never be used just for the sake of protection of other people, even from a horrible disease like Ebola. You want to help people in Africa fight Ebola, send them money. You can go volunteer, but don't volunteer your neighbor's kids by sending the military in. So I think this is – and Ben Carson, look, Ben Carson has an amazing story. He has some very good positions in certain things, but Ben Carson is very religious and very altruistic, and altruism is all over the place on the right as well as on the left, and they can't resist this kind of stuff. This is pure sacrifice, and pure sacrifice is hard to resist. So this is a question about charity. So this questioner asks, she says she thinks private charity is the way to alleviate catastrophes or even ongoing issues without immediate solutions, like healthcare for the poor. She understands that the charity isn't an obligation or a virtue, but that creates conflict within her because she cares deeply about humanity and she contributes to all kinds of causes all over the world. And by doing so, she believes she's helping people and so on. But if it's not a virtue and it's not an obligation, should she continue doing this? She knows it's immoral to pressure anyone else to give money to things they don't want to. But her concern is, how does she share this way of thinking generally? Because most of the objectors, you know, don't give to charity. Then how can we argue that charity will solve problems? So I guess she says the question really boils down to, do you honestly think private charity would be able to fund crisis in an entitlement-free world society? Yes and no. I like this yes and no stuff, right? So first let me say that, absolutely, charity is not an obligation. Charity is not where you got your moral worth. Charity is not a moral virtue. And charity has to be really thought about in terms of, is it rationally in your self-interest? And the problem I think you have, the question, and I think many of us have, is that we grew up and we were inculcated by altruism. So it's very hard to differentiate between I'm doing this out of a sense of really this is in my rational self-interest, this is a cause, I really believe it, I think it's going to rebound to me in some way, it's going to make my life better in some way, or am I doing this because I've been trained to do this, because my emotions are leading me towards this, the altruism. I have an eradicated altruism from within me. And I think that's hard for many people. And I think most people, most objectivists who give to charity today, other than to the Ayn Rand Institute, to the extent Ayn Rand Institute could be counted as a charity, are doing it because of a sense of altruism, a sense of obligation. And I think they're doing it for the wrong reason. I think the only nonprofit you should give money to is the Ayn Rand Institute and similar organizations that are fighting for freedom, because that is the only important battle out there. You're not going to solve any problem, healthcare problem, women around the world, any problem around there. I don't know. She mentions reproductive healthcare for women around the world. poverty in Africa, Ebola, none of these problems will be solved long term unless objectivism wins, unless we win the case for liberty, for freedom, for real freedom, for reason, for rational self-interest. So you're throwing the money away from a long-term perspective, from a rationally self-interested long-term perspective. You know, I believe that all of you objectivists out there, all of you support laissez-faire capitalism and support rational self-interested reason, should be supporting the Ayn Rand Institute. And I think you should be doing it because it's in your rational self-interest to do it for the reasons you mentioned. You care about the world in which you live. You care about your own life. You care to some extent about other people. And the only way to have an impact on those other people, in a lasting way, in a meaningful way, in a way that lasts, is to help bring about a better world. And the only way to do that is by changing the culture. And the only organization, or the primary organization dedicated to changing the culture, is the Ayn Rand Institute. And you should be focusing your giving, your nonprofit giving, your tax-deductible giving to the Ayn Rand Institute, your investment in cultural change, the Ayn Rand Institute. I don't give to anybody else. I don't, because the extent that I have some money, I spend most of the money on myself and my family. I save because I think it's important to save. And any money I have that I think is available to give to a cause, I give to the Institute. And let me just add that Leonard asked that you all know that the only nonprofit he contributes to is ARI, and that he disagrees with the whole idea that we should be doing charity to support all these other causes today. You know, yes, in a laissez-faire country where you're not paying any taxes, where where everybody's so much better off, charity would be a minor, tiny little thing because we'd all be so wealthy and we'd have so much money because we wouldn't have to carry the burden of the state and everybody in the entitlement state with us. Yes, in those cases, you do some charity to help poor people and to deal with catastrophes and to deal with earthquakes and things like that. But it's small. It's insignificant because you're free. But you're not free today. Your primary focus today in the struggle to change the world should be your own life and working towards your own freedom. So here's a question. What advice do you have for the Israeli government given the current pudding debate over the cost of living in Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities? How else can the government of Israel liberalize its economy? By the way, this is the same debate happening in many Western countries like the UK. I was in the UK and there was a whole discussion about cost of living. This is a huge issue in many, many countries and to some extent in many places in the United States, Southern California, New York, where cost of living is a real issue. And so what should be done? Well, let's take Tel Aviv as a quick example. What needs to be done is government lands needs to be sold off to developers in mass. The government shouldn't own any land in Israel. It should be all sold to developers. What you would have is a lot of development of new apartments, condos, houses, which would lower the cost of housing because a massive new influx of supply. Demand wouldn't change, but supply would go up dramatically, so costs would go down. Also, that would be one, land. Get government out of the business of land. And this is true in the UK where they have green belts, where they have all these restrictions of building outside of London, which make London incredibly expensive. And then the number two is regulation, regulation, regulation. You have to get rid of them. And there's so many of them, regulations on how to build homes, regulations on where to build the homes, regulations on, on concrete and subsidies. And what you have to do is get rid of the subsidies, get rid of all the subsidies, get rid of all the taxes, and get rid of all the regulations. And cost of living would go down dramatically and standard of living would go up dramatically. And this is true of Tel Aviv. It's true of New York. It's true of London. The solution to the cost of living crisis is to get government out of the way, which would lead to increase in the supply of the things that are constrained right now. The prices are going up. And an increase in the standard of living and an increase in individual wealth.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peakoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.